All right, welcome in everyone to the deep dive. You're ready to get our hands a little dirty today?
Always up for a good deep dive. What are we digging into?
Well, we're going to be looking at something you might not typically think of as like super exciting school finances.
Okay, I'm intrigued. Tell me more.
Yeah, so we've got a whole stack of these audit reports for the Bethel School District number I3 out in Oklahoma.
Audit reports, huh? That sounds, well, thorough at least.
Neuro is one way to put it. But honestly, there's some real gold buried in these things. We've got reports covering 7 fiscal years from June 2016 all the way up to June 2022.
So we're talking a pretty comprehensive look at how this district's been managing its money over a significant chunk of time. What's the goal here? What are we hoping to uncover?
Think of this as our attempt to demystify school district finances. We're going to break down where the money comes from, where it goes, and what kind of rules and regulations they have to follow along the way.
Sounds like a solid plan. I'm sure there are plenty of folks out there who would love to have a clearer understanding of how their local school districts handle their finances. Let's get into it.
All right, let's jump right in. So, the very first thing that jumps out at you when you start looking at these reports is how they actually put their financial statements together. It's not the standard way most organizations do it, right?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. So they consistently use what's called a regulatory basis of accounting, which is essentially a specific set of rules laid out by the Oklahoma State Department of Education.
Okay, so they're following the state's specific guidelines instead of like the more common national standards.
Exactly. It's different from what's known as U.S. Generally Accepted Accounting Principles, or GAAP, which is the more widely recognized standard used by a lot of businesses and even some government entities.
And this difference in how they report things, this regulatory basis versus a gap, it actually leads to a pretty big issue that the auditors keep flagging year after year. It has to do with their fixed assets.
Ah, yes, the missing fixed assets. That's a consistent theme throughout these reports. So, for those who might not be familiar with the term, fixed assets are basically the big ticket items a school district owns. You know, like the land the schools are built on, the school buildings themselves, major equipment, things like
As if they're most valuable possessions, right?
Exactly. But because they don't keep track of these assets in the specific way this regulatory basis requires, the auditors can't actually determine their total value. It's like a giant question mark hanging over a significant portion of the district's overall worth.
That's kind of wild to think about, isn't it? Like, imagine not knowing how much your house is worth. And here's where it gets even more interesting, because they're using this regulatory basis instead of GAAP. For those fiscal years ending 2018 through 2022, the auditors actually went so far as to issue an adverse opinion specifically about whether their statements were in line with GAAP.
And just to clarify for our listeners, an adverse opinion is a pretty serious matter when it comes to financial audits. It means the auditors believe the financial statements are not presented fairly according to those widely accepted accounting principles, specifically due to the accounting methods being used. It raises some important questions about why the state might have this particular regulatory framework in place and what its limitations might be in providing a more comprehensive financial picture. It kind of makes you wonder what the rationale is behind using this different system.
It definitely makes you wonder, right? It's like they're following the state's rules, but they wouldn't pass muster under the national standards. Okay, so let's move on and talk about how the district actually organizes its money. The reports detail a whole bunch of different types of funds they use. What are we looking at here?
Yeah, this is pretty typical for how public entities like school districts manage their finances. It's basically a way of separating their money into different buckets, each with its own specific purpose. You can almost think of it like having different compartments in a wallet, each dedicated to a certain type of spending.
So, like one pocket for your everyday spending money, another for saving up for something big.
Exactly. So their main compartment, their primary operating fund, is the general fund. This is where all the federal money they receive gets deposited, and it covers a wide range of expenses. Then you have these special revenue funds, which are set up for more specific purposes. There's the building fund, which, as the name suggests, is for construction, renovations, and maintenance of school buildings.
Keeping the lights on, the roof from leaking, all of that good stuff.
Precisely. Then there's the co-op fund, which is for participating in joint programs with other school districts, pooling resources to offer specialized services or programs that might be too costly for any one district to do alone. And of course, there's the Child Nutrition Fund, which, as you might guess, is dedicated to providing school meals.
Breakfast, lunch, all that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then to keep things organized for paying off their debts, they have a debt service fund. specifically for setting aside money to cover their long-term loan payments. And for those big one-time projects like building a brand new school or making major upgrades, they use capital projects funds, which are often funded through bond sales.
Right, like when they go to the voters and say, hey, we need to build a new high school. Are you willing to approve this bond measure?
Exactly. And the bond fund falls under that capital projects umbrella. There's also an insurance recovery fund, which is basically a rainy day fund for dealing with insurance claims and making repairs to damaged property. And then there's the agency fund, sometimes referred to as the school activities fund. This one's specifically for money raised by all the different student groups, clubs, and sports teams.
So, like, the money from bake sales and car washes all goes into that fund.
Exactly. And unlike all those other funds we talked about, they're not actually legally required to have formal budgets for the agency fund.
Yeah.
It makes sense when you think about it, because the money coming in and going out really depends on what all these different groups are doing.
It's like a mini economy operating within the school district.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. And, you know, one thing I found interesting is how broad the description of what the building fund can be used for is. It's not just about putting up new structures. The reports say they could use it for a really wide range of expenses.
Give us some examples.
Well, it covers everything from actual construction and repairs to things like utility costs, insurance premiums, buying security systems, and even paying the salaries of security personnel. That's a pretty flexible pot of money.
Yeah, you could do a lot with that. So how does the district go about deciding how much they're going to spend each year? That's where the whole budgeting process comes in, right?
Exactly. The state requires them to prepare an annual budget for all of those funds we just talked about, except for the trust and agency funds, which operate a little differently. The whole process kicks off with them putting together a preliminary budget, which they have to submit to the Board of Education by December 31st every year.
So they start planning pretty early for the next school year.
Oh yeah, definitely. They have to get all their ducks in a row. And if they need to get the voters' approval for things like raising local taxes to, say, generate more revenue for a specific purpose, they usually hold an election for that on the first Tuesday in February.
And those are the classic bond measures and levies we often see on our ballots.
Exactly. Now, here's a fun little wrinkle. The district can actually ask voters to make certain local taxes, like those for emergency needs and general local support, permanent, so they don't have to keep going back to the voters for approval every single year.
That kind of takes some of the pressure off, huh?
It does. But it also raises questions about transparency and accountability, right? How do you ensure that those funds are being used effectively and responsibly if they're not subject to regular voter oversight?
That's a great point. Now, one thing you always see in these audit reports is how they present the budget, showing both the original plan and the final adjusted amounts. Why is it so important to see both of those figures?
It really boils down to getting a more complete picture of their financial decision making.
Mm-hmm.
The final budget reflects any changes they had to make throughout the year. You know, things happen. Maybe they get an unexpected grant, or maybe costs go up in a certain area and they need to shift some money around to cover it.
Kind of like when your own personal budget gets thrown off by like a surprise car repair.
Exactly. Life throws curveballs. So seeing both the original and final budget side by side really lets you compare their initial intentions with how things actually played out financially during the year. It's a much more nuanced view than just looking at the final numbers.
Okay, so let's talk about what the district actually owns and owes. We touched on fixed assets earlier, but let's look at some of the other things they list as assets and liabilities. Cash seems pretty straightforward. It's the money they have on hand and in their bank accounts. What about their investments? What are we talking about there?
Well, the reports tell us that their investments are mainly in very safe, low-risk options, like those U.S. government bonds and treasury securities we talked about, and certificates of deposit, which are basically like super safe savings accounts with slightly higher interest rates.
So they're not exactly playing the stock market with taxpayer money.
Not from what we see in these reports. They seem to be taking a very conservative approach with their investments, and they consistently record these investments at their original cost, which is standard practice. And here's a fun little detail. Year after year, from 2018 to 2022, they had this very specific, unchanging $10,420 investment in CDs.
It's like they just tucked that money away and forgot about it.
It's just this little quirk that pops up consistently in the reports. Moving on, we have their long-term debt, This includes any bonds they've issued to finance those big projects we talked about earlier, and capital leases, which are basically like long-term rentals for things like equipment. They record these debts as liabilities when they take them on.
So it's all about keeping track of what they owe. And then there's that cash fund balance, which is basically the leftover money they have that hasn't already been earmarked for a specific purpose.
Right, think of it as their available spending money at a given point in time. Now, remember that agency fund we talked about earlier, the one for all the student groups? Well, they list the funds held for school organizations as liabilities within that fund. These amounts can fluctuate quite a bit.
Why would they list those funds as liabilities? That seems counterintuitive.
It's a technical accounting thing, but essentially it reflects the fact that this money doesn't belong to the district itself. It's being held in trust for those student groups. They have an obligation to manage those funds responsibly and make sure they're available to those groups when they need them. And the changes in those balances, up or down, really show us how active those student groups are in terms of fundraising and spending.
So it's like they're acting as bankers for the student body.
Precisely. For example, the total amount held in these accounts went from $233,231 in 2018 to over $310,000 by 2022.
That's a pretty significant jump.
It is. And if you dig into the detailed financial statements, you can actually see the individual balances for groups like the Elementary School Fund, the High School Student Council, the yearbook and newspaper clubs, the band, athletics, and even scholarship funds. The changes in these individual balances from year to year tell a fascinating story about which groups are really active, which ones are successful with fundraising, and how they're spending their money.
It's almost like a window into the social dynamics of the school.
It really is. You can kind of piece together which activities are the most popular and which ones are maybe struggling to stay afloat financially. Okay, so let's switch gears and talk about where all the money comes from and where goes the district's revenues and expenditures.
The income and the outgo. Let's break it down.
All right, so their main sources of revenue are, unsurprisingly, local property taxes, state aid, which is determined by a complex formula set by the state government, intermediate revenues, which can include things like tuition payments from other districts for students who live outside the district but attend Bethel schools, and federal funds.
So it's a mix of local, state, and federal dollars.
It's that classic three-legged stool of school funding. And it's worth noting that all the federal money they receive goes directly into that primary general fund, which is used for their day-to-day operations.
And how are those local property taxes, which are usually a big chunk of their revenue, divided up?
They're allocated to three main funds: the general fund, the building fund, and the sinking fund, mm-hmm. which, if you recall, is the one specifically for paying off debt. The allocation is based on these specific tax levies that have been approved by voters for each of those purposes.
So basically, a portion of your property taxes goes to each of those buckets.
Exactly. And property taxes are collected in two main installments, with the first half due before January 1st and the second half due before April 1st every year. So they get a nice steady stream of revenue from property taxes throughout the year.
Okay, so let's talk about how they spend all this money. On the expenditure side, the categories look pretty standard for a school district. Instruction, support services, operating non-instructional services, and things like facilities acquisition. But what exactly does instruction encompass? That seems like a pretty broad category.
You're right, it is a broad category, and it basically covers anything and everything directly related to teaching and learning. This includes, of course, salaries for classroom teachers, but it also includes things like co-curricular activities, which are those extracurriculars that are tied to the academic curriculum, like debate clubs or student government.
So not just sports and band, but the more academic-focused stuff too.
Exactly. It also covers things like homebound instruction for students who are unable to attend school for medical reasons, instruction in hospitals for students who are hospitalized long-term, and even the costs associated with alternative learning methods, like online learning or independent study programs.
It really does run the gamut, doesn't it?
It does. And within that category, you also have things like salaries for teacher assistants and any tuition they might pay to other school districts if they have students who need specialized services that Bethel can't provide.
So it's a pretty comprehensive accounting of all those direct educational expenses.
Absolutely. Let's shift our focus now to their longer-term financial obligations, their long-term debt.
Right. We talked about bonds and capital leases earlier. So how much debt are we talking about here?
The district's primary long-term debt consists of those bonds they've issued to finance those big projects and capital leases for things like equipment. Remember, whenever they want to issue new bonds, they have to go to the voters and get their approval. And once those bonds are issued, they have to be fully repaid within 25 years.
So it's a significant financial commitment that they have to carefully manage.
Absolutely. And we can see how their debt levels have changed over the years, covered by these audit reports. For example, their amount of bonds payable increased quite a bit, from $970,000 in 2017 to over $2.7 million by 2022. That's a pretty big jump. And capital leases also fluctuated significantly during that same period, going up and down as they acquired and paid off different leases.
It's interesting to see how those numbers move around. What else do the reports tell us about their debt?
Well, they provide a detailed schedule outlining their debt service requirements for the coming years. Basically, this lays out exactly how much they're obligated to pay each year in principal and interest payments to service those debts. It's all very transparent, which is good for accountability.
It's like peeking into their future payment schedule. Now, another big part of school district finances is the whole employee retirement system. Can you walk us through that?
Absolutely. So the Bethel School District participates in the Teachers Retirement System of Oklahoma. This is a statewide system that provides retirement benefits to teachers across the state. Now, it's important to know that this retirement system uses a cash basis of accounting, which means they record their income and expenses when the actual cash changes hands, as opposed to when those transactions are made or promised.
So it's a different way of tracking their finances compared to how the school district itself operates.
Exactly. And according to the reports, at the statewide system level, the pension benefit obligation is actually underfunded. This means that the total amount of money they have set aside to pay future retirement benefits is less than the estimated total amount they'll eventually owe to retirees.
So there's a potential shortfall in the system.
That's the concern. However, it's important to remember that they don't do these detailed actuarial valuations, which are those complex calculations that project future retirement costs at the individual school district level. So we're only seeing this broader picture of the overall state system's financial health, not specifically how Bethel's contributions are doing within that larger pool.
It's like looking at the overall health of the forest without being able to examine individual trees.
That's a great analogy.
Yeah.
And the district's own contributions to this retirement system have varied over the years, ranging from around $500,000 in 2016 to over $564,000 in 2021. So it's a significant annual expense that can fluctuate quite a bit, impacting their overall budget.
Okay, let's switch gears again and talk about federal funding. The reports show that the district receives a fair amount of money in federal awards. Where does all that money go?
Well, the good news is that those federal funds are also reported using that same regulatory basis of accounting we talked about earlier, which keeps things consistent with the rest of their financial statements. And across all the years covered by these audits, they received a clean bill of health when it came to how they were managing that federal money.
What does that mean, a clean bill of health?
Basically, it means that the auditors found no instances of non-compliance with the complex rules and regulations that come with accepting federal funds. They also didn't find any what are called questioned costs, meaning they didn't see any red flags indicating that the money might have been misused or misspent. So it appears they're doing a good job of following the rules and being good stewards of those federal dollars.
That's reassuring to hear. And there's a specific section in the reports called the Schedule of Expenditures of Federal Awards, right? What does that tell us?
It gives us a really granular breakdown of all the different federal programs they're participating in and how much money they're receiving and spending on each one. We see programs like Title VI Part A, which is designed to support Indian education, and the Child Nutrition Cluster, which, as we talked about earlier, includes the National School Lunch Program and the School Breakfast Program.
So we can see exactly which federal programs are benefiting the students in this district.
Exactly. And the amount of money going to these different programs can change from year to year based on various factors, like the number of eligible students, changes in program guidelines or funding levels, and even things like local community needs.
It's a dynamic landscape for sure. Now, beyond just looking at the numbers themselves, the auditors also spend a lot of time assessing the district's internal controls and compliance. What are we talking about here?
So internal controls are essentially all the policies, procedures, checks, and balances that an organization puts in place to make sure its finances are being managed responsibly. It's all about preventing errors, catching mistakes, and safeguarding against fraud or misuse of funds. And compliance refers to whether they're following all the relevant laws and regulations that apply to them, both at the state and federal levels.
So it's like a checkup on their financial health and their adherence to the rules.
Precisely. And remember, those adverse opinions they received regarding their presentation under JAP. Well, Despite those, the auditors generally concluded that the financial statements prepared under the state's regulatory basis were presented fairly, in their professional opinion. And importantly, across all 7 years of these audits, they didn't find any material weaknesses in the district's internal control over financial reporting. This suggests they have reasonably effective systems in place to manage their money.
That's good to hear. What about their compliance with all the rules surrounding how they manage those federal program funds?
No major issues there either.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't report any material weaknesses in their internal control over compliance for those programs. So again, it appears they're doing a good job of following the rules and ensuring that those federal dollars are being used appropriately.
That's reassuring. Now, the auditors do sometimes find smaller issues that don't rise to the level of a material weakness, right? What happens in those cases?
Right. While the main audit findings didn't mention any major instances of noncompliance that would significantly impact the overall financial statements, the auditors did point out that they communicated some less critical observations to the district's management team separately. These are usually documented in what are called management letters, and they were issued in a few of the years we looked at specifically, 2020, 2021, and 2022.
So these are things that need attention, but they're not like setting off alarm bells.
Exactly. They're often more about areas where improvements could be made or potential risks that they should be aware of. It's part of that ongoing dialogue between the auditors and the district's management to help them continually improve their financial practices.
Got it. Now, the very last thing I wanted to touch on is this section in the reports that talks about anything that might have happened after the end of the fiscal year, but before the audit report was finalized. They call these subsequent events.
Right. So this is kind of like catching any last minute developments that might be relevant to the overall financial picture. One thing they consistently point out is that any money they receive from those grant giving agencies we talked about is always subject to the possibility of future audits by those agencies. If those agencies find any issues or discrepancies, they might require the district to adjust their financial statements or even repay some of that money.
So there's always that possibility of things changing down the road.
Absolutely. But the district's management team consistently stated in these reports that they had carefully reviewed any events that occurred after the fiscal year ended and hadn't found anything that would require them to make any changes to the information presented in the financial reports.
So they're confident that they've captured everything accurately.
That's what they're asserting. All right, so as we wrap up this deep dive into 7 years of financial audits, what are some of the big takeaways for you? What stands out?
Well, I think we've seen that this is a school district that's operating within a very specific set of state financial rules. And that leads to some interesting quirks in their reporting, like those ongoing issues with how they account for their fixed assets and the fact that their statements wouldn't necessarily pass muster under the more widely used national accounting standards.
Yeah, those are definitely points to ponder. But at the same time, it appears they're generally managing their finances responsibly within the framework they're given. They seem to be doing a good job of managing those federal funds, and there weren't any major red flags raised about their internal controls or compliance with all those complex regulations.
And I think what's been most fascinating for me is just seeing all the different pieces of the puzzle that make up a school district's financial picture, from the local property taxes that fund their basic operations to the state and federal aid they rely on to provide essential services, and even their long-term commitments like paying off those bonds they've issued to build new schools or make major improvements.
It's a complex web of funding sources and spending priorities for sure.
Absolutely. You know, I hope our listeners now have a much better understanding of the financial landscape of the Bethel School District. It's really easy to get lost in all the technical jargon, but when you break it down, it's all about making sure the district have the resources it needs to educate its students effectively.
And I think the key question for all of us as citizens and taxpayers is to think critically about how our local school districts are using our money. Are they being transparent? Are they prioritizing spending in areas that we value? These are important conversations to have. And I think understanding the basics of school district finances is an essential first step.
Couldn't have said it better myself. All right, that's going to wrap it up for today's deep dive. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.